is Ted Siuba going to be talking about imagination, the workshop of the mind. And basically, I think that that's a core concept. He starts off, Napoleon does, with the book, The Imagination is Literally the Workshop, wherein are fashioned all plans created by man. The impulse, desire, which, by the way, may have been triggered up by imagination. You know, in other words, I would like to make $1 million. Ah, and grow the desire. But also, the desire, that impulse, is now fashioned into plans, given shape, form, and action through the aid of the imaginative faculty of the mind. Because, here's what happens. The first time you become enamored, and I'm just choosing $1 million, we are talking about Think and Grow Rich. You say, man, $1 million. I can do it. I want to do it. I will do that. The next question has to be, how? And that's where you've got to use your imagination and think through some things. And when you start off with that concept, I think we're seeing imagination a little bit different than we may have seen it before. What it really comes to, one statement that I think kind of sums up what Napoleon's point in this chapter is you can build a fortune through the aid of laws which are immutable, never changing. But first, you must become familiar with these laws and learn to use them. Here we are back again, using them, the workshop, doing something with them. You know, nothing will happen unless you do something. And we're not talking about the flighty kind of imagination. We've all think of that, and that's what we think of. Oh, great, you know, this person's a writer because they can't get their feet on the ground. Well, first of all, by the way, if they're producing, they're not all the way flighty, are they? Even if the subject that they're dealing with is flighty, like some of these romance novels, speaking of Chapter 10 and sex transmutation. But anyway, this is a chapter of work, effort, use, action, you know, bold thinking, strategic thinking, what-if scenarios. Now, if all this sounds like work and planning, let me suggest another thing that I believe, from my in-depth study of this book, Napoleon did. I've never heard anybody say this before, but each principle has a number, and imagination is the fifth step toward riches. Guess what? The Pentagon, where our war house, where we do all the war, where we do all the planning, where we do all the what-if scenarios, where we make contingency plans, where we determine who we're going to do what first, when second, how to accomplish our goals and objectives, this is the imagination. And I believe that Napoleon chose this principle number, as well as all of them, for specific reasons. This relating to the Pentagon being our house of war in the USA, and the work and the consciousness and the vigilance that I'm talking about. Really, what Napoleon Hill repeats again and again throughout the book, and it is one of the secrets, if I may be so bold as to say that, but we take a conscious vision. I want to make $1 million. And we decide to convert that desire, that intangible impulse, that thought, i.e. think, into its physical equivalent, which is money, houses, cars, you know, and all the rest of the stuff. But the point is it doesn't happen unless it happens by design, and you're going to have to do a lot of other things along the way, like do the organized planning, like make the decisions, like be persistent, like focus your energies. And imagination is saying, hey, you know, this is going to be work, so go for it. Another point that he brings out here, and I'm really intrigued with this because I believe it's so true, and it really relates to a lot of his metaphysical aspects. Most people miss it, but, you know, believe me, sex transmutation was not the only controversial thing Napoleon was talking about. He also was talking about autosuggestion, the sixth sense, the subconscious. And so what he's saying is that the human brain is both a broadcasting and receiving station for the vibration of thought. Okay, vibration equals energy. Vibration, if it is substance, it is moved, and then it is turned into energy. That is the thought. That is the motion. So what, now then, Napoleon takes us to the next step. He says, now, anytime we have thoughts that are mixed with the feelings of emotions, i.e. sex transmutation is one of them, there are other emotions, these become a magnetic force, which attract from the vibrations of the ether other similar or related thoughts. In other words, deep thoughts attract other deep thoughts of their similar kind. This is the reason why we can go for thousands of years, and then somebody makes an invention. They've been deep in thought in the laboratory on that invention, and that same invention may have been invented two or three other places at the same time. It's because the energy was there. What Napoleon is saying is, and this is true, by the way, because you can see it in the synchrony of the planets, in the organization of galaxies and solar systems. They're all tied together with magnetism. And it, there is only E or M, you know, as in E equals MC squared, energy and matter. So every energy that moves develops a magnetic field. You know, I mean, the Earth's magnetic field. Why? Because it's moving. You cannot help it. So what Napoleon is saying is that whatever thoughts you put out, you tend to attract. Whatever you need for the fulfillment and accomplishment of your goals, dreams, ambitions that you're deeply committed to and working on, you will attract. Now, this is no more, you know, incredible if you will take the metaphysical leap of faith and believe that somehow what he's saying is true. No more incredible than you stub your toe and you pop it up into your hands and you start rubbing it and trying to soothe it. Well, what do your hands have to do with your toes? The pain is not in your hands. And the end truth of the matter is your hands may not really solve it, but it's connected. There is a connection. And that's one of the things that Napoleon keeps talking about again and again. Another point that he talks about in this chapter, and it is ironic in the chapter that he's identified as the work chapter, you know, and go to work, even though we're talking about imagination, something seemingly contrary to work. He says, if you are one of those who believes that hard work, honesty alone will bring riches, perish the thought. It is not true. Riches, when they come in huge quantities, are never the result of hard work. Riches come, if they come at all, in response to definite demands based upon the application of definite principles and not by chance or luck. Here again, we're coming back to the same ideas. Organized planning, imagination, mystery of sex transmutation, using your brain, using your subconscious, using the mastermind, which, of course, Napoleon really, really talks a whole lot about. So, then another idea. Napoleon actually identifies the two different kinds of imaginations, one of them being the synthetic imagination, the other one being the creative imagination. And what I'll do, I'll give a couple of examples, which he gives, to illustrate those two. But the basic scenario is synthetic imagination takes what's known, and it then uses that to build other things that it's designing to. In other words, you go in, you say, hey, I need to, you know, put in this new system in my business that will track my customers. Synthetic imagination goes and says, well, here's the three pieces of software. I'm going to make a choice. All right. But the one thing that's false is this other piece that this other program has, so therefore I'm going to get that programmed in. In other words, you're taking what exists. The creative imagination is really interesting because it is one of the mysteries he talks about, and it is when ideas come to you. It is when you get ideas, you get fired by ideas. In other words, wow, I am going to raise $500 million for artistic children, and that becomes the passion of your life. That was a creative idea. You'll have a lot of synthetic imagination because you'll have to do publicity. You'll have to figure out, how are you going to do that publicity? Are you going to walk across Texas, walk across the USA? You're going to open up a radio show? You're going to solicit big organizations? All that's synthetic. The creative one is the spark, the drive, the magic. Another thing that it's kind of ironic here, too, Napoleon keeps talking about the secret, you know, and then he says, well, but this secret isn't hard to understand. Strange and paradoxical as it may seem, the secret is not a secret. Nature herself advertises it. And then he talks about, you know, of human being, which came from, you know, just a semen and an egg, microscopic, and then a human being can be 6 foot tall. Planets, solar systems, everything that's planted and grows. In other words, we're back to what another part of what he identifies, it's the old E equals MC squared. Now, I've already referred to that. Einstein is the one who actually codified it into a formula. E being energy equals matter, which is M. E equals M, and then C squared is the speed of light squared. That's that magnificent kind of translating, transmuting energy that comes from outside. But you see, you do have the speed of light or some other factor, but really on one side of the equation is matter, on the other side of the equation is energy. And again, that's what Napoleon Hill is saying, is that the same processes, you get a tomato seed and you have thousands and thousands of tomatoes, well, that's the creative force. And thought impulse, the desire to raise money, create money, is the same beginning. It's a beginning. Things take off from there. One case in point, he talks about the enchanted kettle. Talks about an old Atlanta doctor, a little over 100 years ago, rides up to the back of a pharmacy, and the clerk got his life savings, $500. Back then, of course, that would have been like a monstrous sum today. Gives it to this doctor. Doctor was happy because he had sold his formula written down on a piece of paper and a few pots and pans, and now he could go off, pay his bills, and settle back down into retirement. The guy who bought it, though, saw something bigger, i.e. creative imagination. He saw Coca-Cola in the hands of people worldwide. Now, this is pretty bold way back in, you know, almost colonial Atlanta, which was post-Civil War, but saw that. Now, that was the creative imagination. Now we're back to synthetic imagination. You know, that world domination didn't happen by accident. Back then, they started the painting the sides of the barns. You know, drink Coca-Cola is the big logo. Now, of course, fast forward, we're seeing it on TV and magazines. Worldwide, indeed, that dream came true. I tell you what, it's interesting, too. And I'm actually rewriting this, and I got a section that I pulled out of my rewriting relating to Coca-Cola. The first year sales of all Coca-Cola products in 1886 totaled $50, which, by the way, cost $70 to generate, all out of a single fountain in Atlanta, Georgia, run by a sole proprietor. As I write these very words you see, I'm sitting with my beautiful companion on the beach of the Malecón in Santo Domingo, La República Dominicana. Beside us, a lithe young black boy shimmies up a palm tree, knocks down a coconut, slides down, and carries off his take to mama. Worldwide sales of Coca-Cola last year surpassed $21 billion, and the company directly employs 49,000 people worldwide. And that doesn't count the millions other merchants, institutions, and governments also make, you know, on the product and movement and everything. Is it a coincidence that I'm drinking this same beverage that provides stimulation of thought without intoxication, just what an author needs in order to do his or her best work, 118 years later? Is it coincidence that the red and white beach umbrella guarding us from the intense Caribbean sun says, Disfruta Coca-Cola, which means enjoy Coca-Cola? No, it's not. It's an illustration of the creative imagination, the big dream, wedded with a synthetic imagination. How do I make my dream come true that happened? Hey, and there's another example he gives. A preacher named Mr. Gunselos wanted $1 million for a charity school. He worked. How am I going to do it? And that dream was a creative imagination. Bam! Once he made a decision, and that decision was, I'm going to get that money within 7 days, he was then inspired creative imagination to write the best sermon he had ever written. That was synthetic imagination, putting it together. What do I have to say? How can I appeal to the people who will be in the audience? How can I get the right people in the audience? Which, of course, he put out press releases and et cetera. In other words, he was handling the pieces, the creative imagination, the dream, and the pieces, and go on. So, listen, I wanted to give three examples. I'm going to suggest that you read the book because there's another good example. In the interest of time and getting the input on the from the other members of the $100 million roundtable, I'm going to say that it is imagination, and imagination is all about work, it's all about dreaming, and it's not about work at all, it's about living. It's about doing what you've decided to do.
Well, you know, everybody knows that Albert Einstein said that imagination is more powerful than knowledge, or more important than knowledge, but there's another thing that Einstein said, too, that I think is worth opening up to the panel. He said, most people look at what is and never see what can be. I love that quote. You know, because I believe that there's all these people around that people call them geniuses, especially once they make a lot of money. But all of those people have this one thing in common. They have great imaginative powers. And so, just like what Einstein said, they can look at something and see what it can be rather than what it is now. And then through the power of imagination, now they're able to move forward to turn that into a reality. Don't you guys, and, well, Alan, I know that's what we talked about yesterday. I mean, that's one of your skill sets.
Oh, I love this. In fact, one thing I noted when I was reading this chapter that I thought was so fascinating was when Napoleon Hill listed all those examples of the opportunities that are just waiting to be tapped in radio. I really read through that with great glee. I had a great time. And here's the magic of it. You can replace the word radio with the internet.
Yep.
And you've got yourself sitting in the same catbird seat that everybody was sitting in back in the birth of radio. We went through it with television. There will be others. But if the internet, the cool thing is the possibilities are so infinitesimal. So many of them have not been tapped yet. Imagination is the spark that will create the next big thing.
Sure, and William Blake said that what is now proved was once only imagined, and that's the way it is with lots of things, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. And talk about proved. You know, where Ted was talking about Coca-Cola, it was, as I was reading that story of how the doctor brought that to the pharmacist as a formula and swapped it for the $500, that pharmacist was so brilliant. He said, you know, at that time, I am sure, and I know it's a proven fact, cocaine was a part of the original Coca-Cola formula.
That should have helped a little.
That's why their slogan was, it gives you a lift.
Well, and at the time, here was the flash of brilliance, I think. At the time, and maybe Ted's been studying some more because he's from that whole area, and you know, I don't know, it just seems like you've been looking into Coca-Cola's history, and I don't know this for certain, but at the time, I do know the spring tonics were real popular, and they all contained one standard ingredient, cocaine, and the elixirs, you know, that everybody sold. I'm betting this was a formula for an elixir that the pharmacist looked at and turned and said, you know, we could make this into a sweet drink that gives anybody a lift. And that idea has endured so long now, it's survived switching the cocaine for caffeine. It's survived caffeine-free. And it's so strong, it's not stoppable today.
Yeah, they even have sugar-free Coca-Cola now.
Well, what I thought was so interesting, though, was the interdependency of ideas. The pharmacist had an idea, and it was going to go nowhere with his skill set. The other gentleman had other ideas, but he didn't have the skill set to produce the formula. They each had equal, neither one could have existed without the other. And I think Napoleon Hill overlooks in his comments in this book how important both ideas were to the final result. And you could be either one of those people. You could be the person with your skill set who has a basic idea. But then if you don't have the capabilities to place it into action, then you need to find someone who has the talents and skill sets and imagination to take it to a different level, and you share in the profits. The only thing wrong here was the pharmacist was not big enough in his thinking to work out a profit-sharing agreement.
Right.
You mean the doctor wasn't.
I'm sorry, yeah.
But remember, we're in a book that is announced title is Teaching Us How to Get Rich, How to Grow.
That's right.
And I believe that Napoleon is saying that the people with imagination will always come out ahead. It's the
but
same
both
thing.
Both of them had imagination. That's my point. He overlooked. They both had imagination, and neither one would have succeeded without the other's imagination.
Yes, but we don't have to go way back in history. Bill Gates bought the DOS operating system for $50,000.
Hmm.
Who had more imagination? Now, they both had to have, somebody developed it. They had to have it, but they had more synthetic imagination. Bill Gates has become the richest person in the entire modern world based on what somebody saw as a bowl of soup, and he saw with creative imagination as a revolution in society.
Yes, yes, and let's not forget that in 1975, in a dirty, seedy hotel room in the worst part of Albuquerque, New Mexico, where all the hookers and the drug addicts all hung around, Bill Gates at that time formed a vision for Microsoft, and he wrote these words down. He wrote, a computer on every desk and Microsoft inside of it.
Yep.
But, you know, the lesson to be learned here, and I think Don touched on it, is that the inventor, the originator, has to have that creative thought principle to bring the product forward, the invention. But he or she does not always benefit as much as another creative thinker who looks at the product that has been invented and says, I know how to enhance this, and I know how to make 1,000 times more money with it than the inventor did.
I think it also illustrates the power of the mastermind principle, which you'll learn about on another principle we're covering elsewhere in this series, to synthesize those ideas, to bring forth the ideas, of several people and the power of more than one, combining those insights and ideas into something far greater than either individual could create on their own.
You know, E. Joseph Kostman, one of my mentors who recently died, but had a long, successful career, he made it a practice to find people who had invented things but didn't know how to sell them, and he would buy the rights to them for pennies on the dollars and then make millions and millions of dollars with them.
Look, if for many years I was in the creative business, and if there's one thing I learned, absolute, that I have not seen an exception to, is that people pay money do not pay money for ideas. They pay money for the execution of ideas. The person with the idea seldom is successful with the idea alone. They want to peddle an idea, and it's hard to peddle. But people pay tons of money for the execution of those ideas. Bill Gates bought that. He didn't have the original idea, but to execute it properly, people will pay a fortune for.
Well, and Don, again, that's a great, great place to end this. And Ted, you did a wonderful job of explaining this powerful principle. Imagination really does rule the world. And no matter how qualified or deserving that you are, you're never going to reach a better life until you first imagine it for yourself and then allow yourself to have it. And so, please, I wish the listener would think seriously about this. It's a powerful principle of all wealth. When you study the richest, most powerful, successful people, you'll find that they had vivid imaginations. They believed it before they saw it, and then they set out to make it happen. So please listen to this again and again, and let's go on to the very next principle that can help you make tremendous amounts of money. And now we're going to hear from Jeff Gardner as he explains the next great principle from Napoleon Hill's Think and Grow Rich. Jeff?
Great. Thank you very much, DJ. Well, I'm very excited about my principle. It's organized planning. I think it's a really big key that factors into a lot of success in life. Unfortunately, in most goal setting and money-making opportunities, money-making plans out there, really planning, especially organized planning, is really not focused on at all. In fact, if you go to a seminar, pick up a book on goal setting and getting everything you want in life, what you find is that every one of them has these systems for finding out what you really want and writing it down in the various areas of your life. And after you're done doing that, they're like, yeah, now go do it. You know, run out there and go do something. Take a quick action, you know, and it's all, everything else that you need to know is really kind of swept under the rug. And they never really show you how to do organized planning or even tell you how incredibly important it is. But you can dream all day long, and without an organized plan, you're never going to reach where you want to be. And that's one of the reasons why I really like this principle in the Napoleon Hill book. There's 3 points I really want to focus on very briefly, and then get the group's ideas on organized planning. The first one is Napoleon's idea about planning using the skills, ideas, and expertise of others. I think this is a really important factor because a lot of people I see out there try to be pioneers. They try to do it themselves. They try to figure out every little thing by themselves. And that really is not the smart way to work because other people out there, whether it was 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 50, 100 years ago, have in many cases had the exact same type of problems, had the exact same type of dreams. They've been in your similar situation. They've already done the hard work of figuring out how to achieve what basically you want as well. So instead of trying to figure that out all over again and go through the painful trial and error, why not discover the plans of other people, discover their skills, use their ideas, and use that to get to where you want to go? That really is truly a shortcut to success, using those skills, ideas, and expertise of others. One of the things that this group knows very well, and I think it's going to be talked about in another principle, is the mastermind group. You know, getting together a group of like-minded people that have similar goals and using other people's ideas, skills, expertise, coming together as a group, really, to be more powerful as a group than as an individual. Very powerful. And this is something that is available to most people. I know that you're listening to this thinking, well, how am I going to do that? The best thing about it is you don't have to find these people individually. You don't have to, you know, try to go find a Bill Gates or Warren Buffett or any of these very highly successful people. You can go to your local library or bookstore, and you can get the same type of advice, expertise, guidance from literally dozens and dozens, hundreds of books written by or about these type of people. So you can go into these books and find out exactly what they did, their step-by-step formula, and you can model your own steps after what they've done as well. It's a great way to shortcut the process and use the skills, ideas, and expertise of others. Because really, why do you want to be a pioneer when you can model somebody else and make their life a lot easier? So that's the first idea I want to throw out there. The second one that Napoleon talks about, and this is very important, when you're planning, he says, if one plan fails, replace it with another until you succeed. So if you create this great plan and you go out and you put it into action and it doesn't work, then you simply go out, create another plan, put it into action, and you do that again and again and again until you succeed. You're persistent until you succeed. The problem is, I think, a lot of people think, oh, failure's so horrible, and I'm going to try this one plan, and I'm going to give it this one shot, and if that doesn't work, well, then I'm just going to give up. Because we really have this idea that failure is this horrible thing. I think you need to reframe it in your mind and believe that, no, it's not really failure. It's not this bad thing that I've really built it up into my mind to be. What it is results. It's results. It's either the results I want or the results that I really don't want. And if you look at that way, reframe it that way, you're able to say, okay, I'm going to try this plan, and at the end of it say, okay, did I get the results that I wanted? No, I didn't get them. Well, okay, I'm going to try a different plan, see if I can get those results. Didn't get them that time, I'm going to try a different plan, and continue on and on and on until you get what you want. Now, the key here, of course, is you have to really, really, really want your goal, whatever that thing is at the end of the rainbow. You really have to want it. Because a lot of people, if they don't really have a drive, really have a passion for what they want, it's easy for them to go, well, I tried this one thing, and, you know, it's just so much easier sitting in front of the TV eating bonbons, but I'm going to do that instead of really going after this goal. But if you have that passion and drive for what you really want, it becomes a little bit easier to go ahead and say, well, this plan didn't work, I'm going to pitch it out of the way, and I'm going to try this other plan as well. There's really a few steps here to doing this very effectively. First of all, you absolutely must know the end result that you want. You've got to know what the positive result is that you actually want to achieve before you even create your plan. So you've got to have that very clearly in your mind, very specifically, so that when you get there, you're able to say, boom, I'm here, this is exactly what I wanted. Number two, you have to create a plan using small steps. Using small steps, not, you know, I'm going to immediately make $1 million in the next 30 days. No, you're going to want to start very slowly, especially if you haven't made that much money before. You're going to say, okay, I want to make an extra $100 a day, then $200 a day, $500, and go on from there. Create a plan using very small steps. And the third part of it, which is probably the most important part of it that many people don't do, is to review your plan consistently and constantly. You need to, even maybe on a daily basis, look over your plan all the time. Look over it, decide whether or not this plan is really working for you. Is this heading you in the right direction? You know, I've heard stories again and again about airline pilots that they're focused on getting to a particular place like San Diego or Tucson, Arizona, or wherever it is, and they're always being blown a little bit off course. They're always making these little tiny course corrections so they can ultimately end up where they want to be. Well, whenever you create a plan, don't create a five-year plan. Do it for 5 years, and then at the end of 5 years, go, oh, darn it, the plan didn't work. It didn't work way back 4.5 years ago. I wish I would have changed it then. What you need to do is always stay on top of that plan and make little tiny course corrections. Look at, is this taking me towards my goal or away from my goal? If it's taking me away from it, make that course correction. Focus yourself back on your goal. And now, I'm rushing through this. I really want to get these ideas out here. The third one is a very, very simple and almost deceptively simple idea. But if you put it into practice, it really can change your life in a huge way. And here's what it is. Very carefully. It's the principle of Kaizen. Small, simple, continuous improvement. Continuous improvement on a very small scale, but those small steps added up to make a huge difference in your life. What I mean by that is, let's say that you are hundreds of pounds overweight, and you really want to drop that weight, and you've tried again and again and again and again to do that. Very difficult. A lot of people, you know, take a little bit off, put it back on, take it off, put it back on. Or some people, it's difficult for them to even get started because what they look at is this huge goal. You want to take off hundreds and hundreds of pounds. So what is the first step? Well, I need to get my butt out of bed early in the morning, I need to run around the block 40 times. It's going to take me an hour or 2 hours. I need to get in the gym for 2 hours. I need to go and sign up for a membership. I need to do all these huge steps. What Kaizen says is that don't do that. It says your brain has an automatic function that will turn you off whenever you want to make big changes. It says your brain says when it sees those big changes, it automatically turns down your turns off your brain so that you don't make those changes. Because your brain, in many cases, fears change. It likes the rut. It likes the comfort zone. You may not think that, but your brain likes it. It knows that. It's comfortable with it. So what Kaizen says is don't try to run off to the gym for 30 minutes a day. Don't even run off to the gym. Get up whenever you want to, and for 1 minute, do jumping jacks. Or do one push-up a day. Or do one sit-up a day. And don't even do all those together. Just do one something, even for a minute. And that's it. Now, what happens is the action that you're taking slides under the radar of your brain. And so your brain realizes, yeah, this isn't a big change. This really isn't going to add up to anything. You're able to do that thing for 1 minute a day. Well, there's a flip side to that. Your brain also then realizes, yeah, this isn't so difficult. I can do this for 1 minute a day. And you start doing it consistently. It becomes a habit. So easy, you start doing it for 2 minutes a day. 5 minutes a day, 10 minutes a day, it builds up from there. And believe me, those small steps can have a huge impact. You know, there's this cliche that says, how do you eat an elephant? Well, one bite at a time. You have to make those bites very small, or else you're going to shut your brain down. So I think with organized planning, don't try to break down a huge goal into 5 steps. You need to break it down into 50 steps, or very simple steps. Now, one of the things I talk to people about when they're starting their own business is do something a few minutes a day. Now, usually I say 30 minutes a day, but I'm realizing now that even when I tell people 30 minutes a day, they even have a problem doing that. So I've started telling people, read a marketing book for a minute a day, a page a day, half a page a day, whatever it is, but get into that habit. Train your brain to do that for a certain amount of time a day, and doing that consistently over time is going to get you a lot further than if you have this huge goal that shuts your brain down and that you don't do anything for 6 months, a year, or 2 years, or 5 years, or ever. So take very small steps, and when you're organizing, take that into consideration. Very small steps that will ultimately move you towards your goal. So, 10 minutes, I've run through everything I wanted to talk about. I'm going to pitch it over to the others in the group and see what everybody has to say about it.
Well, that's excellent, Jeff. I wanted to jump in here. This is Alan. And just say another thing I noticed about this chapter on organized planning this principle was that he spent so much time in the chapter discussing getting yourself hired for a premium job as part of the plan, because I feel that's such an important starting point for so many people who don't have the money or maybe still need to build up, you know, their expertise so that they can move forward with their plan. Sometimes the first step may be to work and save the money, but you don't want to waste your time working in a job that doesn't add to the plan, doesn't build on your goal. And so, consequently, you want to go for that prime job. And he outlines in here exactly the best way to prepare yourself, to present yourself, and to make an offer the dream employer can't refuse. I'll work for free. That's an important principle to remember. Give me a free trial. Give me 10 days, give me 2 weeks, whatever you're willing and able to offer. And if it doesn't work out, I'll walk away. We'll both be friends. And the good news, too, is that the preparatory work that Hill outlines so quaintly in this chapter on getting your resume together, he doesn't even call it a resume, is so much easier today thanks to computers. But do follow the steps and include the information presented the manner he recommends. And just remember, you can do it now so easily on any computer, but just go to the trouble to make it look good. Present yourself well.
I'm sorry.
I was just going to say, include the photo. Follow the steps, you know.
Well, yeah, and for those people that never want to have another job for the rest of their lives, that same principle, instead of a resume, now you're looking for joint venture partners, you're looking for customers. The same thing applies. You go for your A-list first. You start out with your best ideas. And or your best prospects, everything is what I'm saying, Alan. It for those that don't want to go out and get jobs.
Oh, exactly. I think that's a great point. And I think a lot of people. But the other thing I think is important to pull from this chapter is a lot of people, when they think they don't want to ever go out and work a job again, we're talking the jobs you used to work. And what's important about what Napoleon Hill points out in this chapter is he gives you the steps to go find a dream job. I mean, don't take less. And that's a good point. There are jobs you can work where the employers enjoy your learning everything you need that fits into your plan to build upon your goals of success. Those jobs are okay, guys, especially if you're coming at it with no money and not enough expertise. It's important to remember that.
Well, and I think that, you know, that's what Napoleon, when he wrote this, and remember it was published in the 30s originally, was thinking of. What does a person have but their personal services when they begin? And that's almost an exact quote. So get that together and you get up and going. And you know, it's not to say that a person couldn't find fulfillment in an organization. I mean, most of the achievers are entrepreneurs. Most of the achievers are business people. But some people, for instance, if you had a great desire to work for the United Fund and to travel in Africa, you could follow that principle. But it gets back to what TJ then was saying, is, yeah, we got to get a job. Or anything else we do, we need to have it designed to serve our needs. And therein is the organized planning. How does this fit into my bigger plan?
And another big services industry today, Ted, you brought that up. Selling your services is a great way to start. And if you want to start your own business and don't want to work for someone else, consulting is an excellent service business, and more people are doing it because it's so easy to work out of the home. Follow the steps. Present yourself to your boss, which in this case would be a prospective client, and aim for the top and even offer to provide them with the services for 2 weeks free or a month or whatever. You don't pay me till we prove we're valuable. You follow the same steps, you're going to land clients.
Well, you know, and I want to jump in here and say that when I had a small chain of bookstores in Minneapolis, St. Paul many years ago, I had this guy, Ron, come to work for me. I wasn't paying him that much, and he worked just like a madman. And he'd come early, and he'd leave late, and I thought, my gosh, I got the world's best employee. So I gave him some raises and gave him more responsibility to manage. And he continued to just learn everything he could about the business, and he continued to work harder and harder. And then all of a sudden he came to me, and he said, I got to quit. And a couple months later, with some money he got from his brother, he opened the bookstore two blocks from me. So, I mean, the point here is some people, they learn all the skills they can from books, but then they learn them on the job, and then they start a business of their own.
Well, that reminds me of the story of John Carlton. You know, John Carlton wanted to be this really great high-priced copywriter, and what he did was basically go work for another great high-priced copywriter and learn everything he could from him, you know, be kind of an apprentice, and then go out on his own. So it's not that you have to go out and immediately do something on your own. There's a lot of skills that you can pick up working for somebody in your same field that then you can apply if you do want to go out and create the same type of business.
Yeah, and I'd like to say something about the plan. We keep talking about having a plan. That's a stumbling block for a lot of people. Not that they don't have a plan, but that they continue to develop an elaborate plan, more elaborate and complete than is necessary. The planning becomes an activity in and of itself, and all the time is spent preparing the plan, and very little time is spent implementing the plan and putting any of it into action. I had a gentleman call me recently to tell me that he was about ready to start a program that he had purchased from me 5 years ago because he had been working on his plan and it was almost complete. And while that is probably an extreme example, it's a very common problem is that people work their plan so much in development that they fail to put it into action. So this chapter talks a lot, or this principle is a lot about a plan, but I think we need to put in a cautionary note here that planning is just a step. It's not the end result of what you're trying to accomplish, and people often get that confused. It's a way to not take action. You're busy, but you're busy developing a detailed plan. And I think also that the plan doesn't have to be that specific. It has to be specific in terms of the goal and what you're trying to accomplish and some reasonable mechanisms for doing that. But I think that you have to be very careful that you don't let this be your end result and your first and final stumbling block.
Well, and everybody knows that the bankers require business plans before they'll loan money. But what they don't realize is that the real intent that the bankers are looking for is just to see how much knowledge that you've gained in terms of the marketplace and the products and services that you're selling. You see, anybody that understands business knows that no matter how much you plan something out, it's never going to work like you think it's going to work on paper. And entrepreneurs know that instinctively because we're constantly throwing ideas out there. And the ideas that we think are going to work the very, very best oftentimes bomb the very, very worst. And the ideas that we think don't really show that much promise and we're not that excited about them, they're very well received into the marketplace and end up making us a fortune. So I've got this thing on my wall here. One of you guys said this to me years ago, and I wrote it down and hung it on my wall. It says, ready, fire, aim. And, you know, I think that's exactly the way that you have to be in this day and age if you're going to go out there and make a lot of money. You can't aim first. You know, ready, aim, fire is all nonsense. You've got to, you know, to fire first, and then you start aiming. And one of my good friends, somebody that's on this panel this morning helping with this tape, told me 2 days ago, he said, TJ, if there's any one big problem that I see you having is that you're always trying to go for the home run every time you swing the bat. He said, you ought to just focus on base hits and try to get lots and lots of base hits. And then some of those base hits could turn into, you know, you could end up crossing the plate and scoring big. And that's good advice, and that kind of applies to what we're talking about here, where I love your analogy, Jeff, about how the plane is always just a little bit off course all the time, and yet it does make it to its final destination because it corrects itself ever so slightly every single minute it's in the air. And isn't that kind of how it is, guys, where you throw something out there, and no matter, you're just kind of changing it as you go, and you're kind of monitoring how well, you know, you're figuring things out as you go. Is there any better way to say that?
Yeah, there is, and it's something about, you know, motion creates motion. I don't know if that's the exact phrase. There's something like that, but I'm sure we all get the point. And I know for myself, once I just start putting pen to paper, even if I really only have the most vague idea of what I want to accomplish, just that action or just getting on the phone with someone or just doing something in the direction from the creation of a thought, even though it hasn't been fully thought out, that's pretty much how a lot of my products and ideas and ventures start. And then something interesting happens, and this happened to me just a couple days ago on the weekend. I went to see a couple movies. We're having the film festival here in Vancouver. And it was interesting. I was really taking a day off completely from business just by myself, left the family, and I just wanted to go have a day and watch some movies. But I couldn't help but write down a whole bunch of ideas just before a movie started and after, and I wasn't really thinking about it. It just came to me, and it was basically filling in the blank from some thoughts that I had been mulling over the last couple of months and hadn't really done much on. It just hit me, and that was only a few days ago, and now I'm you know, halfway through a new product. So it's that initial action of doing something. The something I did with this particular idea was that I did put down, you know, a page worth of notes of ideas. Had I not done that, I don't think the rest would have come to me on the weekend. It was that initial action that set everything in motion. And I could tell you 100 stories like this, and I'm sure we all could. But I think that's the point you were trying to make, TJ.
Well, Eugene Schwartz, my favorite copywriter who's deceased now, used to say that when it came time to write, he didn't have anything to say. And he didn't want to write the copy, but he put himself in a position to do what needed to be done. So in the case of the copywriter, he made a commitment to sit in front of the typewriter for 45 minutes at a sitting, and that was the commitment he made, to just sit in front of the typewriter. And he said when he sat down, he had no idea what he was going to do. He didn't want to write, but he knew he was going to have to sit there for 45 minutes. So he was in a position to accomplish something. So he said after a few minutes, he gets bored sitting there, so he decides to write something. And first stuff probably wasn't any good, and he threw that away, but it still had a lot of time to go. And first thing you know, he was in the process of creating, and it flowed, and then he continued to do that. But he said if he did not put himself in the position for accomplishment, it would never happen. And I think that's what that we have to do, is put ourselves in a position to accomplish it, because if we just think about it, it doesn't ever get done.
Well, yes, and Don, I can't think of any more perfect way to lead into the next Napoleon Hill principle than that analogy, because what he was doing is he was making a decision.